Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Vonna Pfeiffer.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for the needle artists. And our artist this week, oh, this is going to be fun, Krista West of Avlia and Krista West Vestments. Hi, Krista.
Hey, Gary.
Yeah, two companies because you're bored, right?
Yeah, very bored.
Okay, well, that gives us lots to talk about. And this show, sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery, and here is a word from Kim.
This edition of Fiber Talk is proudly sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery. Sassy Jack's is a vibrant young needlework shop located on the picturesque Main Street of Weaverville, North Carolina, happily situated between Five Little Monkeys Quilt Shop and nationally recognized Well-Bred Bakery. We are nestled in a valley of the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains of western North Carolina, just minutes north of Asheville and a short 20-minute drive from the Biltmore Estate, one of America's national treasures. Sassy Jack Stitchery is proud to be a brick-and-mortar needlework shop, featuring cross-stitch, counted needlepoint, embroidery, and punch needle. We host a wonderful collection of fine antique needlework samplers on display, many of which have chartered patterns available for purchase. We frequently rotate our collection, so every visit is likely to yield a new treasure for you to enjoy. We are moving into our fall and winter season of stitching at Sassy Jack's, and we invite you to join us in one of the many opportunities we've created for you to stitch along and learn. We have a return of our tree decorating event, wherein everyone who sends us a newly stitched ornament for our tree by December 24th will receive a coupon for 15% off any single purchase during January and February. This year will also mark our third year doing our special Valentine's Day small exchange. We've opened our designer selection to include Summerhouse Stitchworks and Jeanette Douglas Designs, in addition to Plum Street Samplers. You may stitch any small design from any of these designers using a pattern and supplies from your stash or purchasing something new from us at Sassy Jack's. Finish it into a needlework small and send it to us before January 25th. We will exchange it from another in the group and send you a beautiful gift from your stitching sister just in time for Valentine's Day. Check out our website or upcoming newsletters for more details and finishing tips for these fun winter traditions at Sassy Jack's. We hope you find a way to visit us soon. If you can't make it to us, we hope you visit us online at Facebook, Instagram, SassyJackStitchery.com, and our new FlossTube channel, Yonder Ways. We love it when you stop by and say hi, whether it's in person or online. We truly appreciate you, and we really appreciate all we hear and learn from Fiber Talk. We are super proud to be a sponsor of this wonderful resource for stitching goodness. Thank you, Fiber Talk, for giving us some stabby pokey talk twice a week. Kim and team at Sassy Jack Stitchery.
Hey, thanks, Kim, and thanks for sponsoring Fiber Talk. We appreciate it. And all you listeners out there, please support our sponsors. And as Vonna has said more than once, if you need something, just call Kim. It's simple.
Yep, sure is. Called her today.
I'm sure you did. All right, Krista, the logical approach to life would be to start with Mediterranean folk embroidery and then advance yourself to vestment construction and design.
Yeah, and I kind of did it backwards.
Yeah, you didn't do that, right?
No, I didn't. No. It's actually, if you want, I can kind of tell the story of how I got into vestments, because it's kind of a funny story.
Well, that's exactly where I was headed, so have at it.
Okay, so I grew up in a handy family. My mom did a little sewing and crafting. My dad was a machinist for Boeing, and my dad was also neuroatypical. He had Asperger's syndrome. And so he just thought it was pretty normal to expect a 5 or 6 year old to see in inches. And so I was kind of raised in this environment where I was expected to basically see in 3D. And so I got really into handcrafts early on. It was funny. I was thinking about this for the interview, and I can remember holding a needle before I held a pencil or a pen. And so my parents gave me, and this is really like a really funny, like a neuroatypical parent would do this. So I remember my dad just giving me a sewing machine when I was 8 and being like, here you go, figure it out. And that was really normal in my world growing up. And so I got my first sewing machine when I was 8, and I was doing a lot of sewing. I always had a project going. I would make doll clothes and I make different things. By my teenage years, I was starting to make clothes and really wanting to understand how things were constructed. How did you go from like a 2D pattern that you would buy at the fabric store and go to 3D? But I looked into fashion design school. It was really expensive, and I didn't think it was the right fit for me. I was really interested in literature and history and art and things like that. And so I ended up kind of going on this spiritual quest in my late teens and early 20s, and I ended up in the Greek Orthodox Church. I'd grown up really in no religious tradition at all, and I was just really compelled by Greek Orthodoxy. And one of the first things that really compelled me was the vestments. I took one look at them and was like, oh my word, like how are these made? And like the fabrics are so beautiful and they were intricate and they were big, like they went to the floor and lots of fabric, lots of textile stuff going on. And I was really hooked. And so I was Orthodox for a few years. And then my husband is actually a Greek Orthodox priest. And so when we were in seminary.
Okay, I gotta back you up, Krista. I gotta back you up a little bit. Okay, the whole Greek Orthodox thing fascinates me on a couple of fronts.
Sure.
I spent 10 years doing wedding photography.
Oh.
I do not recommend that as a side job, but I spent 10 years. And one time I did a Greek Orthodox, full-blown, full-metal Greek Orthodox wedding.
Yep.
I was never so scared in my life. The priest greeted me when I walked in there with camera gear and gave me a rundown of what I couldn't do, where I could and couldn't go, what I could photograph. Oh, holy smokes, I had so many rules in my head, I didn't know how to move.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure I did not do the bride and groom any justice because I was just really nervous. He made me nervous. But that was the thing that still sticks with me. I still see that, and it's been 30 years. I still see that church and all the vestments and all the gold and all the ornamentation. Magnificent stuff.
Yes. It was really the aesthetic tradition that drew me to Eastern Orthodoxy, to Eastern Christianity. I just fell in love with it. I just fell in love with the beauty. And the fact that beauty mattered and that beauty, there was such a high value put on beauty. In fact, it's interesting. A Greek Orthodox liturgy cannot take place without vestments.
Oh.
Like you can't just say, hey, we're going to have a liturgy. There's actually in the rubrics, in the rules in Greek Orthodoxy, that the priest has to have on at least an epitrahelion, a stole. And so it's completely interwoven. So we have this very interesting, really, it's a theological approach. And it's that we understand that the physical and the spiritual are intertwined. And so it's a lot of why our aesthetic traditions still continue to this day, that we haven't like simplified our vestment tradition. My clients know, like, never use the S word, and the S word is simple for me. Like, don't even try it. Don't even call me and say, I want something simple. I'm going to hang up on you. Like, don't bother. Because that's just not our tradition. In fact, I like to say in Greek Orthodoxy, more is more. That's kind of the way we do things. And that completely, as a textile person, kind of concurrent with that, with my conversion to Greek Orthodoxy, I was really starting to delve into the needlework world. I had a good friend who was really, who was like, you should read about William Morris and the Pre-Raphaelites. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And I like went on this whole jag about reading about William Morris and the natural dye stuffs. And then I got really interested in early American crewel work and Deerfield work. And I was doing all of this like during the time that I was converting. And it was like all intertwined. And
How is that, Krista? This has nothing to do with needlework. But Greek Orthodox is a rather, in extreme is not the word, but it is an extreme level of religion. And how is it, you had no religion.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
And so obviously the ornamentation, the vestments and all those things spoke to you. And then, as you looked into it more, then the religious aspect just spoke to you then.
Yes, I was particularly drawn. Okay, so I had grown up in essentially this Pacific Northwest redneck family. And so we did like hunting, fishing, no joke. I got my first gun at age 6. So, you know, really hardcore. And I spent a large part of my childhood in a primitive cabin in the woods, like all of that. And so I actually spent a lot of time in nature as a kid. And I'd spent a lot of time solitary as a kid. And that it was interesting enough, it was the echoes of that that I found in Eastern Christianity. I really liked, there's a silent prayer tradition. there's, you know, what a lot of people today would call a meditative prayer tradition that really appealed to me. I love Byzantine aesthetics. I just love that ancient Roman, early Greek look of things. I love it. I love the colors of it. I love the intricacy. Just all of that really appealed to me. And basically, I get that every time, like I'm in a service. That's part and parcel of my spiritual practice. And
that's
the part
I really
love.
You just feel home there.
It did. For me, it was funny because when we were actually exploring Greek Orthodoxy, my husband was the one who was driving the boat. He was actually doing a undergrad in early Christian history. That he was a classics major. And so his area of interest was the fourth century Donatist heresy, actually, which is so obscure. I know. You think what I do is obscure. Yeah. You should meet him. So anyways, and so he was the one kind of driving the bus. I didn't really understand theology. I hadn't grown up going to church much, all of that. And we walked in the Orthodox church and we got in the car afterwards. And I said, okay, you know what? You can go read your books. You can go do what you're going to do, but I'm staying here. There's something about this that just totally this appeals to me. Hmm. And he's like, oh, good. I'm really relieved because I was going to say the same thing. And like, we never looked back. And so we went off to seminary and I was still trying to figure out like those vestments and how they were going to be put together. I knew my husband was going to be ordained. I actually started on this totally, totally, completely ignorant project. I started hand embroidering his ordination set of vestments with single strand silk floss that was dyed by a woman who did museum conservation natural dyeing in Massachusetts. And it was really over the top. And I actually was embroidering the fabric with no way of knowing how I was going to actually sew it together. So it was a total leap of faith. I know it was really stupid and like really awesome at the same time. And that kind of is a lot of things that I do. But so we were in seminary and there was this woman who had made cassocks, which is like the black robes that the priests wear and other things. And we'd ordered one from her and we'd waited and waited and waited and hadn't gotten it. And his ordination was coming up and we're getting desperate. So I call her. This is in December of 1995. And I call her and say, hey, we're really getting nervous about our order. She's like, oh, my word, I lost my assistant. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, where are you in the country? I'm coming. Where are you? I'll be there on Monday. And she's like, oh, okay. Fortunately, she was 3 hours away from me. And that was Leslie Shale. And that's how I started training with her. I took, true confessions, I took 2 sick days from work. I was working in a little engineering firm as a secretary. And just to pay the bills. And I went and started studying with Leslie. And I spent the next 3 years apprenticing with Leslie. And so the first part of the apprenticeship when you're making vestments is learning how they're sewn, learning how the garment is constructed. So I sewed for 30 to 50 hours a week for a year and a half. Mm. It's very intensive apprenticeship because you have to be able to have this like literally mental model in your mind of how the garment goes together. And for example, a Greek Orthodox cassock has 36 pieces in it. And an accomplished and speedy seamstress can do it in about 8 to 10 hours. So these are pretty complex garments. They have welt pockets. They have decorative stitching. They have fully faced, fully lined cuffs, and functioning cuffs, button cuffs that are fully lined. So there are these really elaborate garments. And so I just basically was at my industrial sewing machine 30 to 50 hours a week. And then at the end of my apprenticeship, towards the end, once I'd done all the sewing work and learned cassocks and vestments and altar cloths and all these sorts of things, then I started in on the pattern drafting. And the pattern drafting, basically pattern drafting is to sewing what architecture is to building. So pattern drafting is where you learn to take manila tag and paper and make a 3D pattern and then have that come and become a 2D pattern and have it become a 3D thing. And that was where I just really got bit by the design bug. I mean, once I discovered pattern drafting, I just fell in love. I just loved it. I loved everything about it. And that was what I learned to do. And that was really important because lots of people try their hand as amateurs. And I don't mean amateur in a pejorative way at all. Amateur always, actually the root of amateur actually means to love something so much that you don't need to be paid for it. And so a lot of amateurs try to do the sewing part of vestments. But the problem is the fit. You are fitting essentially 4 yards of fabric around a human body. And if you don't actually understand how to do the shoulder darting correctly or the neck placket correctly, it doesn't fit. And it's not comfortable for the person who has to spend 3 to 4 hours in it, on a Sunday morning. So I did the pattern drafting. And then I thought, you know.
Now, it's all kinds of rules and regulations for what can and can't be in a design?
Yes. Okay, so Orthodox vestments are based off of late antique garments. They essentially originate out of two major garment categories. The first is the tunic, which is kind of a long robe. And the second is what's called the panella or a cloak. And that has become what's now called the Phelonian. But it was essentially a cloak garment that has had some permutations over the centuries, but remarkably little. Like if a person from first century AD saw a Greek Orthodox Phelonian in a church today, they would recognize the garment.
Hmm.
We've had changes, but they've been minor. We've not had any like Vatican II changes where everything got changed, you know, in the Roman Catholic Church. We haven't had any of that in the Orthodox Church. When I did a museum conservation workshop in Greece a number of years ago. That was my first trip to Greece. And I was amazed that like the first day they handed me a 300-year-old Phelonian and it looked just like what I had worked on the week before in my workshop. So that's part of what really like kept me intrigued was that it's this very long standing like human garment tradition. So I finished with Leslie and I thought, oh, this is going to be so awesome. I'm just going to do this as like a hobby job. I'd had my first baby. At this point, it's like, so we're up to like the spring of 1999 and I have this friend who's like super artistic and he's always into something new. And he calls me one day. He goes, Krista, there's going to be this thing. It's going to be really big. And I'm like, okay. He was always like into whatever the next big thing was. And he's like, it's called the internet. And I'm like, the internet? Okay, great. He's like, can I have some pictures and text? And I'm going to build you this thing called a website. And I'm like, okay, great. I think I had gotten an email like the month before. So like, I had no idea what he was talking about. And I give him some pictures. Next thing I know, I've got a website. And within 2 months, we're getting 1,200 hits a month. Unbeknownst to me, I was the very first ecclesiastical tailoring website on the internet. Mm. And I had no idea. And in the early days when the internet, if you guys remember, people didn't shop on the internet in the early days. People were going there for like, you know, rare book sources, or libraries were scanning in their, you know, reference collections. So it turns out my entire client base of like Greek Orthodox priests were already on the internet because they were looking for ancient source texts. And there I was selling vestments. And so we grew 40% every year for 5 years.
Wow.
It was crazy. It was the craziest period of my life. And I had babies like during this time. So it was like super crazy.
Well,
my life,
you
like,
weren't sleeping anyway. So,
oh my gosh, I wasn't sleeping. So why not? So exactly. Yes. So this was a really crazy time. And it was one of those right time, right place things. You know, what was happening in society at this time, like by the late 90s, there had not been home economics classes in American public schools for almost 15 years. And so and then a lot of American companies, like say Janssen and some of the big garment companies, they were offshoring everything. They were literally disassembling their machines and shipping them to China. So like you couldn't even find an industrial machine. Like, so it just so happened that I got in while all these other bigger forces were going on, and there were so few people who knew how to sew professionally. And that was kind of how I got into it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you just started out just doing these things on your own then? And
yeah, I did. I've always been very self-taught. In fact, it was funny when I heard your interview with Mike Parr and he was talking about workshops and classes. I was like, oh, wow, I guess I should do that. Like, I've taken one embroidery class. I've taken one-hour embroidery class in my entire life. Like, that's all I've ever taken.
But clearly this apprenticeship with Leslie Shawl was difference-making.
Absolutely. That, oh yeah, it was critical. Leslie was actually trained at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. So she knew all the professional pattern drafting skills, and that's what I needed. And she knew how to do them for ancient garments. And that was critical. So then I started, that was really critical. The other, I would say that was, of course, my most formative experience. But the second experience was my very first trip to Greece. And that was where I did a week-long museum conservation workshop in Crete. I was on the island of Crete in a tiny village at a monastery, and they were preventatively conserving 95 pieces of vestments.
And you got to help?
I got to do that, yes.
Wow.
A friend of mine saw the class offered online, And I called them and they were like, yeah, sure, fine. If you want to fly from America and join us, you're totally fine as long as you pay the fee. And so I show up in Greece. I speak no Greek at this point. It was pretty much a trip. And it was all these like Greek museum conservators and it was a riot. Like for them, it was like a really fun like work trip for them because they got to go to Crete. Crete's kind of the Hawaii of Greece.
Yeah.
And so anyways, yeah. And so, but that week was huge because I got to see things that were 300 to 400 years old and I couldn't see anything like that in America. Like there aren't vestments that are that old in America.
Yeah.
But in Greece, there are everywhere. And that was just fundamentally life-changing for me. And just being in Greece was huge for me because it's really like, I think of it as my artistic home. When I go there, it just completely creatively like lit me on fire. And just to be immersed in, you know, everything. Like, okay, they use marble on the sidewalks. And I'm like, even that, like, just totally, like, trips me. I love it, you know?
Well, yeah. It's interesting that you're in that situation because just a couple weeks ago, conversation with Claire Hunter about her book, Threads of Life. And one of the themes that we ended up using frequently was how needle and thread cut through so many language and cultural barriers and just tie as a bad pun, but, you know, bring people together. And
they do. And I've had so many experiences like that in Greece. Like one time I was in, and I mean, I am fearless and I just don't have any shame about the fact, I mean, a lot of people have shame if they can't speak a language. I mean, you give me three words in Greek and I'm going to use all three of those in every hand signal I know. Like I'm super shameless. And I don't have that, like that shame surrounding like not knowing a language. I'm just going to use whatever I've got. And so I have gone into like chapels and seen older ladies like sitting and doing handwork. And I will stop and say, I am from America. Tell me what you're making. And then, but I've learned also in Greece, I never go anywhere now when I'm in Greece without having some of my own handwork, like in my bag so that I can pull it out and tell them I made this because otherwise they don't believe me. Because they don't think that anybody in America does this.
Right,
it's really funny.
Right. Yeah. So during that week, what were some of your experiences? That had to be eye-opening on several fronts.
Oh, man. Well, okay. So the first day, they give us our little white museum conservator gloves, and we have to put those on. And they march us over to this storeroom. It's kind of like this big closet. And there are, like, all of these vestments hanging there. And I'm just, like, stunned at, like, this huge collection. Because it's in a monastery. It's not a huge monastery, but it's a small monastery. And they've got a really nice collection there. And this is all their stuff. And they're just, I mean, they are just jammed into these closets. And I'm like, this is such a wealth in my world where, you know, a priest today, you know, may own 1 to 5 or 6 sets of vestments. And here's probably like 50 of them. And the first thing they do is they're so nonchalant about it. And the first day they just hand me this felonion. They just kind of dump it in my arms because we're taking it from the storeroom back to the library where we're doing the conservation work. Got my little white gloves on. And they just throw it over my arms. And I look at it and there's this little piece of paper pinned to it. And it says like Father Athanasius or something. And it says like 1784. And I'm like, oh my God, like I'm holding something from 1784. And then
they're just throwing them over your arms.
They're like, whatever. And then, you know, but it's really funny too. Then I had this really hilarious, like very funny travel experience at the same time. So one evening, and at this point, my Greek, like I have no Greek. I can say please and thank you at this point. And one evening they're like, okay, you coming tonight? And I'm like, coming where? They're like, come back here tonight. I'm like, okay, I'll come back here tonight. We come back. It turns out one of the monks from that monastery was made metropolitan, was made bishop of the entire area. And they had this huge party and it was so great. They like had all these trestle. It was like literally out of a film. They had these trestle tables set up. They had all this wine laid out. They had goat and lamb and all this stuff laid out. They had a news crew there. It was a riot.
Wow.
And we're like, it's like this great big party. It was like out of some Italian mobster movie. I mean, it was hilarious. Yeah. That was one of my really fun experiences. I had a lot of great experiences in Greece. Yeah.
And so then as the week goes on, you're actually getting your hands in there and restoring these things?
We are doing some minor restorations. We don't, in a week, you can't do that much. Most of what this week was about was cataloging and making sure that these pieces were on file with the Greek Ministry of Culture. And so that was perfect for me because I didn't need to do any like hands-on like needlework restoration and there wasn't time for it. What I needed to see was as many pieces in front of me as possible. so that I could have kind of this visual snapshot. And I had my camera with me, and I could take pictures of stuff so that I could then take it home and kind of digest it. So for me, it was
perfect. Yeah, I was going to say, I'll bet you went home with a ton of pictures and notes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
What an experience.
It really was.
So have you been able to go back and do more of that kind of work?
Yeah, I haven't done any more conservation work, but I'm in Greece now every 2 years to meet with suppliers, because the majority of our fabrics now and our trims and things like that come from Greece, because we can't buy this stuff in the United States. I mean, there's a couple of liturgical brocade suppliers here in the United States, but they tend to do more Western stuff, and the Eastern stuff is quite a bit different. And so it's different in coloration. We favor polychromatic brocades instead of monochromatic. So like, we love brocades that have like 5 colors in them and not just one. And so I'm in Greece every couple of years, and then I meet with suppliers. I'm always in Athens and Thessaloniki both. And that was actually how I discovered Greek folk embroidery is a couple of things happened. It was maybe 3 or 4 trips ago, maybe about 10 years ago. One of my suppliers, his mom was an English teacher in Greece for 30 years. So her English is amazing. And she saw me at one point. I think I was waiting in the shop to talk to him, and I had my handwork out, was working on it. And she saw me. She's like, "Wait, do you like that stuff?" And I'm like, "I love this stuff." And she's like, "Oh, come see my prika." And I'm like, "Okay." So the prika is the Greek women's bridal chest. So it's a tradition that's dying out, but it's still done. I still hear about it being done. When a girl's married, her mom and aunts and grandmothers will put together like this box of all these historic embroideries that are like have been in the family, or they'll make things specifically for her. It comes out of a tradition from like the probably like, you know, 1400s, 1500s, in which it was absolutely necessary to have textile goods. Like, you would literally freeze to death if you didn't have bed curtains. Mm-hmm. So it comes out of that tradition. And so Evie shared her entire prika with me, let me take photos. In fact, my very first Greek folk embroidery that I ever did was actually from the one that she learned in school. She was like, "Oh, this is the one that we learned when we're in school." Because back in the day, they actually started Greek children embroidering at first grade. And they would embroider all the way through. In fact, they even make a fabric called skolio. It's the school fabric. It's the one for learning at school, which is pretty funny. And it's actually really great because it's kind of more open weave. It's real easy to work on. You can see your stitches really easily. But so I started looking at that and being like blown away, which is really kind of funny, because back when I was like my late teens and early 20s, I was like really full of myself as a textile nerd. And, you know, in all of my, you know, superior knowledge at that age. And, you know, that was back in the like, you know, late 80s. There was a lot of cross stitch ducks and geese going on. Lots. And, you know, the quilt in the day and all that kind of stuff. Well, I was off reading about Amish quilting and Deerfield work and all this kind of stuff. So I completely turned up my nose to cross stitch. I thought it was like, oh, cross stitch. I mean, I was totally snobby about it. I was really rude to my mother about it. Like, all of this, you know, that was my teenage rebellion, was, you know, I can't stand cross stitch. And here I am, like, you know, 20 years later, rediscovering, oh my word, this is what cross stitch has always wanted to be. Like, it's almost like carpets and geometrics and all these amazing designs that you can see that are like 2,000 and 3,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so Evie showed her prika, which was great. But then my other friend Dimitri was like, "Oh, you like that stuff?" I'm like, "Yes." And he's like, "Do you want to go to an Egrohiro shop?" And that's a handwork shop. And the shops like this in Greece, they're called Egrohiro shops, handwork. It's the work of the hands. And they have a little bit of everything. Like, they don't have specialized shops like we do here in the States. It's pretty much a little knitting, a little embroidery, a little fabric. And so Dimitri's like, "Oh yeah, there's one right here. You know, there's one a block away. Let's walk over. I know the owner," which is like how it goes in Greece. And so we go over and he introduces me to Maria, who's the owner. And Maria has amazing English. And I still actually work with Maria to this day. And Maria's like, "Are you really? You like, you do this? Like, you're American, but like, you know about this stuff?" I'm like, "Yes, I do." I'm like, "Do you have any patterns?" And she motions over. She goes, "Oh yeah." She motions over to this table, and it's a huge table. It's got to be like a 6-foot by 8-foot table. And there are these 3-ring binders laid out on the table, but they're like the largest 3-ring binders I've ever seen. They're like the size of a newspaper, like laid out. So they're huge. And there's like 3 of them sitting there on the table. And I go over and start flipping through, and there's pattern after pattern after hundreds. of these patterns, and some are like vintage patterns that like DMC and different companies like printed in Greece in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But then a whole lot of this is just photographs. There's just photographs. And I am like, I'm literally almost hyperventilating because I'm so excited. I'm sitting there, my heart is pounding. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is the mother lobe. She goes, oh yeah, don't miss the ones underneath the table. And I look under the table, there's 20 more of these under the table.
Oh my.
So we're talking thousands of patterns. And so I started working Greek embroidery. And I started, I kept thinking, well, I'll just do this for a while and like, I'll then move on to something else. That was 10 years ago. I haven't moved on. And then she was like, well, do you want to see the traditional fabrics that we work them on? I'm like, yes, please. And so she started showing me like the Archiavito fabric. And this is actually the fabric that is in most of our Avlia kits. It's really distinctive. It's a modern reproduction. It's now machine made, but it's based on the hand woven fabric that was their counted thread fabric that they would use in Greece. And it's very distinctive. It's got this lovely kind of warm, weedy color, first off. It also smells great, which is like a weird thing. But like when I pointed out, people are like, oh, it really does smell good. It smells like wheat for some reason. And then, but it has this unique property that you work on it and you do your counted thread. And it's a 26 count. But it kind of like takes up, it kind of folds like wool does over time. And so you can work a 13 count piece on it and it ends up looking more like a 26 count, but it ends up looking more like you worked it on like 30 count linen. It kind of tightens up over time. It gets this like really cool texture. Anyways. Yeah. So that's how I started doing the Avlia kits. People just started asking me like, well, do you have a pattern for that? They would see me working on it and be like, do you have a pattern? I'm like, yeah, I can put together a pattern. And I knew nothing. Like, I knew nothing in this whole industry. Like, I was such a babe in the woods. I had no idea. I had no idea that there was, like, a normal cross-stitch software pattern. So I found WinStitch, which is, like, this quirky design software that's by this guy in England. Bless Jim's heart. He's answered every, like, 50 emails that I've sent him. Like, how do I copy this? And how do I do this? And how do I do this? And he's been super lovely about him. So there's a shout-out for WinStitch.
Let's go back to the vestments though. Yeah. Tell me about the materials, because that's got to be a different world too.
Oh, that's a different world. Yeah, I had no idea when I got into vestments that I would spend fully a third of my time sourcing. Because the thing with vestments is we make our vestments to last for a minimum of 20 years of use. With proper care and cleaning, they should last for a minimum of 20 years. And I have clients now that I've been doing vestments for almost 25 years, and I have clients now that are sending their stuff in to be relined. So we basically slit out the linings and put new linings in, and they get another 10 or 15 years. So it's not uncommon for vestments to have a lifespan of up to 40 to 50 years. Hmm. And so, but you can't just shop for that kind of stuff at the local fabric store. And so the materials that we use, we have to be really careful about it. So our brocades come in a number. We use kind of a couple of different varieties of brocades. The two kind of basic brocades that we use is one, we call on our website, we call it standard brocade, but it's 100% polyester brocade. Years ago, I used to work on rayon brocades, but they have bias shift problems and they can droop over time. They're also kind of thin and I worry about durability. Now, I really like the poly brocades because they are really tough. They are pretty hard to destroy. And they also come in all these amazing patterns.
That fascinates me because I thought you were going to say cottons and silks.
Yeah,
and
I know. Everyone thinks that.
Yeah. Huh.
I know. And even me as a fiber person, I mean, there's a part of me that's like, oh, I have to work on polyester. I mean, through confessions, like if I could sew all of my vestments on silk brocades, oh, I would be a happy camper. But there just isn't enough demand. And so we do poly brocades. We also do a lot of real metal brocades. And what those are poly brocades that are woven through with real metal fibers. So that's like, that would be like microscopic versions of like, say, bullion twist, just kind of like woven into the fabric. And those are beautiful. Those are my favorite thing to work on. They're just stunning. They tend to be polychromatic. They tend to have lots of, and they have big motif repeats. Oh, actually, I just released one on Instagram yesterday. So like blue ochre, it's a gorgeous design. Big spray of roses in this kind of Egyptian vase. Lovely French blue background. Greens, blues, corals, pinks. All of that like in the same brocade. We also work on a lot of brocades that are tricolor. And I love those. So we'll work on things that are white and gold, but with a red accent, or like white and gold with a forest green accent. And those are done a lot in Greece. We really, again, tend towards polychromy. Interestingly enough, in Byzantine silk weaving, monochromatic silks were not actually introduced until about the ninth century. And scholars think that that was actually like a fashion fad, that it was a fad that didn't catch on. So they always prized more color. Well, I mean, if you think about it, in the ancient world, when dyestuffs are literally a commodity, when 1 pound of Tyrian purple cloth is worth the U.S. equivalent of $20,000, yeah, you're going to go for color. You know, that 90s minimalist thing just isn't going to work for you, you know? So, yeah.
Now, when you're designing these things, do you have freedom to design, or do you get designs dictated to you? How does that play out?
Oh, okay. So I have a pattern library of my all my pattern masters. So say I have I'm making a set of vestments for a priest. I have actually quite a lot of design opportunity in the choice of fabric, the trims, the kind of crosses we put on it, and then additional ornamentation. So the basic Philonian, say the basic long cape-like garment, if anybody saw my Big Fat Greek Wedding or my Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, that's the thing the priest is wearing when in the scenes in the church. Fun fact, I actually consulted on my Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, which was super funny. The costume department actually called me. They'd found my book and they called me. It was really hilarious. I actually thought a client of mine had set it up as an April Fool's Day joke because they called me on April Fool's. But it wasn't. But so I have that big Philonian. And now I can decide, so say I have a client that is in, okay, so say I have a client who's in a rural area of America and he does not have a dry cleaner nearby. And I'm like, okay, we need to go with something that is actually machine washable. So we might choose a less ornate fabric that looks more like a hand woven piece of fabric. And it might be red and white, and we'll put a hand woven galloon on it, and we'll keep all additional ornamentation to a minimum. But then say I have a client who's in a big city parish and maybe it's his 20th anniversary and the parish is like, knock yourself out, get your favorite set of vestments. We're like, okay, we're going to do everything. And we might in that sense do what's called a high back Philonian, which is where the back portion of the Philonian goes up higher. It actually goes up about halfway to the priest's head. It's just another variation. And we might do what's called a hand embroidered silk eponometis. It's a section that's sewn into the top of that. They're hand embroidered in Greece or in India with metal thread work. They're stunningly beautiful. They're very expensive. And we set that into the brocade and we put extra galloon. Galloon is trim. We put extra trim. We might add some velvet additional ornament bordering to it, that sort of thing. Those two vestments are from essentially the same pattern, but they're going to look really different. Mm-hmm. So I actually have a lot, and that's actually something a lot of my clients come to me basically for my eye, because they know that I'm super picky about materials and I won't do anything that I don't feel like works. And that's why I won't let my clients choose galloon. I won't let them choose the trim. Years ago, I used to do that. And then they would inevitably, they're not in the workshop. They can't see how that gold is too amber for this brocade, or that gold is too light, or it looks ticky-tacky on this brocade, but it looks awesome on this other brocade. And so I basically just told my clients, tough luck. I choose the galloon. I mean, once in a while, I'll let them choose the crosses. If I'm feeling generous, I'll let them choose the crosses. But I'm really obsessive and picky about that whole process.
Now, do you make garments and altar pieces for other religions, or are you just focused on?
No, pretty much, because we're so busy. I still do the majority of the cut and fit work myself. And my daughter, my 19-year-old daughter, who's been apprenticed to me since she was 13, she is now starting to learn the cutting work. So she's just now, I am just now 25 years in getting help with the cutting work. And we have 8 subcontractor seamstresses that work with us. So there would be no way for us to take on more business in another tradition. And I don't really have anything to offer that. I'm not trained in Western vestments. I'm trained in Eastern vestments. Mm-hmm. So yeah, pretty much I stick with just Greek, Russian. But within that, I work with Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Romanian Orthodox, Serbian Orthodox, basically pretty much any Orthodox church I work with.
Okay, so you have a pretty broad range then to draw from.
Yes, very broad.
Oh, okay. Because I was thinking, if you're stuck at Greek Orthodox, that's rather limited, I would think.
Well, yes and no, and but like yeah, because like Russian Orthodox has a slightly different aesthetic, so like they tend to like a little bit different brocades than say Greeks do. So yeah, and like my Serbian clients, they're gonna like something that's yet again even different. So I do have a lot of variety depending on what version of Orthodox they are.
Yeah. And then you mentioned your book.
Oh yeah, my book. Yeah, it's all right. I never thought I'd write a book. Right around the time I was doing the conservation work in Greece, part of what really motivated me to do that was that my clients were starting to ask me questions that I didn't have the answers to. So they would come to me with like, "Well, why are the Ixodoson sleeves wider for a deacon, for a priest than a deacon?" I'd be like, "I have no idea." And so I thought, "Well, I'll go to the library and I'll just get a book." Well, I went to the library and there weren't any books. And so there was lots of books on Western vestments. And so I'm a really avid reader. And so I started reading and researching. I have a friend who's a librarian, and she basically taught me how to use all of our library's academic resources. So like JSTOR, interlibrary loan, and all that. And that really like opened up the whole world of garment and art history research to me. And so I began researching. And at first, it was just for kind of my own knowledge. And then I got asked by Ancient Faith Radio is a radio program. It's a radio program for Orthodox Christians, and they run a gazillion podcasts. And I was at a conference like, I don't know, like maybe 10 years ago. And they were like, "Hey, we've got all of these podcasts on like theology and deep topics, and we need something a little more light." And so I always joke that that's how I got to be the dumb blonde of AFR. So I got to talk about garments and vestment traditions and all that like fun and fluffy stuff. And so I started podcasting for them, and I actually thought it was just going to be a couple of podcasts, but I've basically been podcasting for them off and on for the last like 10 years. And then the seminaries started flying me out to like go over, just share what I knew, and I would give little lectures on vestment history and where the garments came from and all this kind of stuff. And I've been doing that at St. Vladimir's Seminary in New York for a couple of years. Then I was at another conference because I would go every summer, and I would usually, that's where I would meet with clients. I would go to like some sort of big convention, and I would have my stuff out, and I would talk with clients and meet and measure and all that kind of stuff. And so I was at one of those, and the dean of St. Vladimir Seminary came to me and he said, "Well, we want you to write the book on vestments." And I started laughing. I was like, "Right?" Because I was like, "Okay, great. Now we have to come to this thing that we have to, this hurdle that we have, and that's that I only have a high school diploma. I got married at 18, always wanted to go to college, and never had time. And by the time I got to doing my apprenticeship with Leslie Shale, I had like found my passion, found my love, and I didn't need to go to college anymore. And so I was like, "I don't have any letters after my name. I have nothing to offer you." And I will never forget what he said to me. He was like, "You know what? If the research is sound, we'll publish it. We don't care about a degree." And
No.
I'm like, "Oh, okay." And so I spent the next 4 years knee deep in research, and it was fascinating. And part of why no one had written a book before was because it's a very multidisciplinary subject. I had to read Byzantine silk economics. I had to read about the Roman embroidery guilds. I had to read about color theory. I had to read science books on dye stuffs. So I had to read so wide that most people in the art history world, as they progress through their degrees, they keep going deeper and deeper and deeper into a subject. But this required a very broad approach. So the fact that I actually had no degree ended up being like this total asset in this whole project. Because if I could find it on JSTOR, I could read it and I could like, learn something more about like the whole world of garments. And yeah, and then after that, the book came out, and it was the first comprehensive book in English on Orthodox vestments. Not that it's like, I mean, I feel like it could be way more comprehensive, but then I'd probably bore everybody to tears.
Yeah.
So
I can imagine what that did for your business, though,
yeah,
with all that
interestingly enough,
background.
yeah. And then I started getting asked to speak. And so now I don't do, I had to take this last year off. I was in so many airports. I had gotten really sick. And so my doctor was like, "You got to take a year off of flying." And so I had to take a year off. But this next spring, I'm going to be able to start traveling and speaking again. And like I'm speaking in Pittsburgh, and I'm speaking in Santa Rosa, California. And yeah, so anyways, in fact, actually, after I finish Nashville, I'm literally getting on a plane and doing a speaking engagement the next day in New York, and then flying and then going on to Pittsburgh to do another. So
You're
yeah.
gonna get sick again.
I know. I'm like, okay, I'm researching immunity and herbal stuff and like how to keep, yeah. But I'm keeping my travel to a minimum just to try it out for like a 3 month period, and then we're gonna reassess. Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right. We'll be monitoring.
Yeah, I know. Well, my husband totally. He's like, okay, you can't get sick.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't want to get sick because I love my work so much.
Yeah.
I mean, I love going out and speaking because I love getting people fired up about these aesthetic traditions and helping them see, because we don't have any of that. And, you know, in America, we don't teach art in schools, and people, the average person is really confused. Like, I mean, like, they, you know, is something pretty? Is something beautiful? Like, is it even okay to say that? And I love going and just really opening people's eyes to this kind of stuff. It's just really fun.
Yeah, I can imagine. And all right, so you rediscover cross stitch in Greece. Yeah. At what point did your mother say, "I told you so"?
Well, yeah. Isn't that funny? Actually, she was very gracious and didn't. So okay. Yes. So yes.
All right. Good. She's all right. 10 points on the mother scale for that.
Yeah.
So that's a whole different thing. That Mediterranean look, and I really enjoyed going through the Avlia.
Avlia, it means courtyard in Greece.
Yeah,
and in Greek, and the courtyard. It's kind of funny. It's kind of a play because the courtyard is actually where the women would have sat and embroidered, and these courtyards are actually like in the house. So like houses are kind of built around this like courtyard. Yeah. I actually got to go in one. Well, wasn't like I really got to go in one. I kind of shoved my way into one day in Athens. So we're in Athens. We're walking. My kids are with me on this trip. My husband's there. We're walking by this house and they're building. They're obviously doing some sort of construction. So like people aren't obviously living there. And the door is open. They're taking materials back and forth. And I can see this little courtyard in there. And I'm like, oh, I got to see that. And so I just walk up the steps and walk in, and I'm like, I'm just going to do this until somebody tells me no. My husband is like, what are you doing? Like, you're going in somebody's house. It's a construction zone. I'm like, I know, but I'm so curious. I have to see this.
That poor guy. He must be on edge all the time.
I tell you, he's just, you know what? He's so supportive. I know, living with me, it's got to be a challenge. But so the construction guys are like, hey, and I'm like, hey, I'm from America. I've learned to start everything with like, I'm from America. Like, excuse my idiocy because I'm from America. And so I'm from America and like, I'm really curious about this. And they're like, oh yeah, come on up. So they like bring me up to the second story where they're doing all the remodeling, and I'm talking with the workmen, and they're letting me see the view of Athens out the window and everything. So that was like part of it. I got to see the courtyard where like all the embroideries were done, and there's like little benches there and usually a tree that grows in the center. And that's like where women would have sat like in the kind of, you know, in the afternoons or whatever. And they would have sat and worked on their embroideries. And I just love that image. And that's why I named the company that.
Yeah. But the designs and the color combinations and they're so awesome. Unique.
I know they are. And so a lot of repetition. So a lot of repeating patterns. In fact, actually, I got an email from a client or from a customer last week, and she was like, oh, I love the all over. I call them all over designs. It's like those repeating designs. And those are super common in Greece. Every woman has at least one or two of them in her preca. And they're these like, they vary in size, usually anywhere from like maybe 8 inches wide by like maybe 15 inches long, to all the way up to like big ones that are more like 18 inches by 36 inches. And they're just a single repeated pattern done for the entire embroidery. And they're stunning because it's like embroidery making like this whole textile design. They're beautiful. I'd like to do more of those. They're time consuming to embroider because they, you know, they almost cover the entire cloth. But those are definitely, in fact, I'm working on a new design right now that I actually adapted from a window covering, a window grate that I saw in San Francisco. But it reminded me of Roman tile work. And so I'm actually working on a new one right now. Yeah. I love those. So the all over design is big. The other thing that's really big, like in Greece, when you go into someone's home, it's helpful to understand how people use textiles in their homes in Greece to explain the way their embroidery works. They always have, it's so funny, in most Greek homes, they always have a coffee table and two end tables. Like every Greek home I've ever been in, like this is the setup. They must get married and be like, okay, we need the couch, the two end tables, and the coffee table. It's like a thing. And it's very routine there to have this setup. And so they oftentimes will have sometimes a 36 by 36 inch piece on the coffee table oriented diamond fashion. Okay, so that will be maybe a bigger, more elaborate embroidery. And then they'll have smaller embroideries on the coffee tables, usually coordinating. Sometimes they're even sold in sets of three. You'll get the big coffee table size, and then you get the two little end table size. And so this is why so border styles are really popular. So that's why, like, my Byzantine Zoe pattern is one of those. And the Byzantine Rose is another one. The other thing that's popular along with those are runners. They use a lot of runners and they double end them. So that's like, it's like a border design done at each end of a runner, like facing itself. And those are gorgeous. And those are oftentimes finished with like fringe. They'll take like the leftover floss and they'll just make fringe and then just stick the fringe on the end of it. And those are really neat. Those are where you see a lot of like the urns, like my Grecian urn series is all adapted from those kind of patterns.
Okay.
So yeah, the Mediterranean floral design that I have, the runner, that's a classic design. That one's pretty straight up, like as you'd see it in Greece. Okay. And I try to I like the stuff that's like, you know, let's do 15,000 stitches because that's just where I live. I love that stuff. But when I went to Nashville last year, Susan Fitzgerald of Stitched Modern told me, she goes, how about some smaller things? She goes, I love it. She goes, but how about some smaller things? And I was like, oh, I can do smaller. No problem. And so that's why we started doing like Grecian urn and like the Pelopoli and the smaller designs, is because she was saying, you know, a lot of stitchers find the bigger designs intimidating. And I don't want Avlia, like I want Avlia to be just as accessible to the beginning stitcher who's never picked up a needle as it is to the person who's been stitching for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I want it open to everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, do I perceive a color palette that's very different?
Absolutely. What does it? Yeah. Did you notice what color's missing?
No, purple. I didn't.
Blue purple. The color blue purple is almost nowhere to be found in the Mediterranean color palette. And that is because that color was actually, it's funny, people hear royal purple or Tyrian purple, and they hear that purple and they envision blue, the color that we call purple, that blue purple. That is not the color they're referring to. When in the ancient world, when they talk about Tyrian purple or royal purple or porphyrios, that color is a very deep burgundy. It's almost like a brownish burgundy.
Hmm.
And it is from the Tyrian purple dye stuff. It's actually from sea snails. It was the most phenomenally expensive dye stuff in the ancient world. They still don't know how to recreate it. No one's had luck. But one thing we do know is that there was a kind of a secondary, less valued dye bath run off of the Tyrian purple that created that bluish purple color, and the Byzantines called it hyacinthos, hyacinth. And it was not as valuable. So you don't see it anywhere. It's very interesting to me that I can look through all of my historic patterns and there is never purple. There's just never purple. And when I was researching for the book, I actually, interestingly enough, the color, that difference in color palette was something that at first I had color in my book and my book notes as I was preparing my book. I had this little chapter, like this little subheading by itself under fabric, like just this little tiny couple of paragraphs. And then I started researching and realizing, oh my word, this is a huge topic. I spent months researching color and it actually became a 35-page chapter in its own right. And a lot of it has to do with how ancient versus modern color perception and all of that. And it's very much, you can see that even today in the folk embroidery tradition. And they also really love reds and they love really saturated colors. The reds, the deep blues, the kind of tealy greeny blues. When looking at my DMC floss cones, I have reds, blues, greens, golds, black. And that's kind of my palette.
Hmm. And that services pretty much all you need then. Okay.
It does. Yeah. And actually I find that as a designer, I find that really interesting. Every once in a while, I just stick up all my DMC cones on my table and I just kind of start playing around and looking at different color combinations. But I actually find it helpful to have a limited palette that I can't just do anything. It's actually really helpful because certain colors, like sometimes I'm sitting there making kits on the table and I'm making two different kits with two different, you know, color combos. And I set a cone next to another and I'm like, oh my gosh, like those two talk to each other really well. And like, I didn't know that, like until I was like making the kits. Yeah.
I was intrigued that you offer machine embroidered products.
Yeah, we do. Because again, my whole... Yes, it's really funny that we actually offer ready-made machine embroideries on a site that's for making your own.
Yes.
And a lot of that is because I'm really about people having permission to put as much beauty into their homes as they want. And I know lots and lots of people who appreciate these textiles and find making them completely out of their wheelhouse. They're like, I am never going to sit and embroider. I am never going to do that. But I want something beautiful in my house. And I'm like, okay, so here, there, you have this. And they make these in Greece. And part of it is these machine embroideries are basically the low-cost versions of heirlooms. So when you don't want to have your Prika piece on the table, you can put a $50 machine embroidered piece on your table, and it still looks beautiful. So,
and if Uncle Joe spills coffee on it, yeah, we're okay.
Exactly. I use them that way in my own house. Like when my 9-year-old is, you know, sitting at the table eating spaghetti, I put the heirlooms away, you know?
Yeah, good move so, there.
And, yeah. So I felt like, again, I'm about getting embroidery and textile beauty out to as many people as will listen. And so that's why I felt like the machine embroideries were just another good way to do that. It's going to reach people that embroidery kits won't.
Yeah. Now, when we talked prior to this, you were describing your house and your workspace, and you gave me such a beautiful mental image of what you have there.
I am way beyond blessed. So 2 years ago, my husband took early retirement. We had served a parish for 20 years, and there was another young priest who needed the assignment, and so we took early retirement. It was like the best decision we ever made. But housing in Portland is very important. I was in Portland, Oregon. It's very expensive. And there I had a 400-square-foot studio that I had built behind my house. And mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty awesome. That was great. But basically within a month of building it, we had outgrown it. And so I had actually like had to run electricity to my garden shed and was storing fabric in my garden shed. It was not a good thing. So we had always, my husband and I had always wanted to own an old home. And the home we had in Portland was sort of a make-do home, and we really wanted an old historic home. So we started looking around where in the area that would be, you know, not too far away, but that we could do this. And that turned out to be Salem, Oregon. Salem's the capital of Oregon. And it has actually the largest collection of craftsman homes in the Pacific Northwest. We did not actually end up buying a craftsman home, but that's an interesting fact. And so what we ended up buying was a 1923 home that had been custom built for a doctor. And it's by a noted Salem architect. It's actually on the city's historic register. We're not in the national register. And it was a mess when we moved in. We moved in November, and it had no heat. And there was like all these weird, like, oh my gosh, a lot of weirdness going on. Three separate heating systems, none of which were actually working correctly. So we basically took this on. My husband took this on as his quote unquote retirement job. We joke about him being like busier in retirement than he ever was before. And so we started renovating. But one of the biggest appealing things about this house, the house is actually built as two rectangles. And so it means there is an enormous basement. The basement is 1,400 square feet. It's enormous. And so I got like the workshop of my dreams. So, I mean, you know, we had to add some electricity so that, well, we did that actually after I blew out an entire circuit using my iron, which was really stupid. But so we've had to work around some of the old house issues. We use a lot of LED lighting because it's so much, it draws so much less amperage on our old knob and tube system. And we basically
now that's an old house right there. Yep.
It's an old house. But I love it because I for the first time ever, I actually have all my brocades on warehouse shelving and I can see them as I work. Mm-hmm. And so that's really helpful. I just love it. So we've got the storage space we need. We now have multiple cutting tables. We were able to get a little bit more machinery. So that was great. There was things like I had wanted an industrial serger for a while and we just didn't have the room for it. And it also meant too that like we have a little section of the workshop that's entirely devoted to Avalia, where like all the Avalia kits are live and you know all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of amazing to me. I was actually reading in Stephen Johnson's Where Good Ideas Come From, and he was talking about when people rehabilitate old spaces and like breathe new life into old spaces, and he talked specifically about like basements in old houses, which is really funny. And it is amazing. Within a month of moving into a bigger space, like suddenly our sales were up. It was like the most eerie thing. Sales were up, and I just had like creative explosion. And I think before I was just so hampered by working in such a small space.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. So it's great. We live in this great space, and we still have a lot of work to do on the house, but we're getting there slowly but surely. Yeah.
Now you have your daughter, and who all work with you then?
Okay, so I have three daughters. My oldest, I have a big gap. So, you know, funny enough, actually, during the research for the book, I had a baby at 40. So that was another exciting chapter of my life. So I know, just when I wasn't busy enough. But my older daughters are 21 and 19, and they both are sewing subcontractors for me. So my oldest one does a little bit of work, but my middle daughter, Nora, she actually does a lot of work. She sews probably somewhere in the range of 35 to 40 hours a week, and she has worked her way all the way up through her apprenticeship and now sews pretty much everything and is now beginning to learn the cutting and fitting work. She's 19. She's probably, you know, who knows if she, you know. We don't put any pressure on her to like take over the business or, you know, any of that sort of stuff. I'm just really grateful to have her work with me because, you know, I trained her myself. And so, you know, we do things the same. It's really great.
Yeah.
And then I have about six other seamstresses that work in their homes, most of whom have been with me for a really, really long time because they love the work. They love the craft. And they're contract seamstresses. So, yeah. Yeah. So we do. That's how we do it.
Boy, that's great. Yeah, and I'm sure in that business to have longevity is very important, so you know what you don't have to have redos, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And these are women who are at the top of their sewing knowledge and their craft, and they take pride in their work. And it's not there's not a lot of opportunity for highly skilled seamstresses to do this kind of work. Like, you know, if you're lucky, you can do drapery. Okay. But drapery is kind of boring after a while. this kind of work is constantly like it really requires a really intense level of focus and attention and skill. Yeah.
Krista, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. It was an honor. It's great. It's really fun to talk about this with people who know this world. Yeah.
Well, it's fun to hear about it. And that whole vestment world is, that's just fascinating. So, yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this. Thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks to Sassy Jacks for sponsoring the show. And we'll be back next week.